quite an honor to be here. This is going to be a less technical talk. I'm someone that interviews subject matter experts rather than being one. So for several years, I've been talking to many of the leading figures in early universe cosmology, creating a film series on YouTube called Before the Big Bang. So it's proved somewhat popular. We've had more than 1 million views on some episodes, and some of the cast members are actually in this room. So the motivation was to create an educational resource for people like myself who are interested to learn about competing models at the Big Bang. So my talk is going to be a sort of journalistic report from the field, aiming for a breadth rather than depth, trying to cover a lot of different models. And NIH asked me to bring an outsider's perspective, so I try to do that. And if I make any mistakes, definitely correct me. So quick aside, I started this journey as an amateur astronomer, curious about cosmology. These are some images I took from my apartment in central London. And light pollution is not always a problem. You can get around it. But anyway, the films focus on inflation, alternatives to inflation, and potential prequels to inflation. So let's quickly remind ourselves that inflation claims to solve the monopole problem, the horizon problem, the flatness problem, the structure problem. And inflationary cosmologists claim these as successful predictions, so that the universe is nearly flat and the fluctuations of the CMB are nearly scale invariant, they're adiabatic, they have a nearly Gaussian distribution and a red tilt in the power spectrum. So we have a theory with great explanatory virtues, make successful predictions. What more could you want? Well, having discussed it with some of the critics, these are some of the problems that they raise. So there's too many inflationary models. The probability of inflation started is claimed to be low. No explanation of what came before inflation, not connected to a theory of quantum gravity. We had the discussion this morning of the trans-Planckian problem, and there's also the swampland conjectures, which may give tension for inflation. And some of the predictions that are claimed to be attributed to inflation actually predate inflation, as Robert pointed out earlier. And of course, there's the multiverse that's supposed to arise from inflation, and the measure problem that goes with that. How do you make sense of probabilities if you live in an infinite multiverse? So if you want some more in-depth discussion, these are the papers I would recommend. After the Planck results came out, E.S. Steinhardt and Loeb may publish a paper very critical of inflation. Remember those names, because there's going to be a twist at the end of our story. So remember those names. And the response paper was from Guth, Kaiser, and Nomura. So I've discussed it with these guys, and I want to give like a very brief summary of some of the back and forth between the two. So from the proponents, we've got the claim that the generic predictions of inflation are confirmed. And then you've got this counterclaim, well, look, you've got so many inflationary models, of course some of them are confirmed by the data. The reply is that, well, of course, there are three parameters in the model that have to be fixed by observations. That's true in the standard model of particle physics. And then the hit back is, well, yes, but in the standard model, there's way more data than three parameters. So that's not the case in inflation. So I put that to Guth, and he said, well, look, there's no reason to expect correlations more than 2 degrees in the sky in a map that's got 1 billion pixels in it. So he's claiming that there's effectively 1 billion data points being explained. So I think that's sort of the bone of contention. Is this 1 billion data points or not? But having spoken to Steinhardt, if you don't know, Steinhardt is one of the creators of inflationary cosmology, and he's turned against it. And talking to him, his main motivation, I think, is the multiverse. He really hates that. I know Rob, it's been described as evil to me earlier today. So I thought I should just explain the arguments going back and forth between the proponents. So let's start with a case for the inflationary multiverse. It seems to arise very naturally from inflation. You might say most models of inflation are eternal, but perhaps not all. When I interviewed George F. Stathio, he was the person chosen by ESA to present the Planck data at the press conference, and he told me that Planck favors these plateau models of inflation, which are eternal. So there's a claim that Weinberg used the framework to predict the small value of the cosmological constant, and it connects very nicely with the landscape of string theory. So eternal inflation sort of populates the landscape. And there has been a claim that there's a sort of duality between the many worlds of quantum mechanics and the multiverse. I did ask Nomura to explain that, but I couldn't quite follow the explanation. So you'll have to watch a video.
I've never followed anything he's ever said.
Okay, good. I'm not alone then. That's great.
Don't take that as a criticism.
Right, well, it isn't just Neuro, because Susskind and Busso also made the same claim. There's also the more general argument that multiplicity is the default in nature, and that it can help solve anthropic coincidence. So why do we have life-permitting values for the constants of nature? Isn't that some incredible coincidence? Well, if there's lots of universes, of course we're going to find ourselves in the one with life-permitting values. So to give an outsider's perspective, if I had to pick the strongest one, it appears to me that I would pick that inflation does seem to naturally give rise to a multiverse. So the way I think we can think about it is that you have this false vacuum undergoing exponential expansion, but it's also undergoing exponential decay. So when it decays, you have one half-life and you get a pocket universe. And what's left is the false vacuum, which is also exponentially expanding. So basically, it's like having a cake. Every time you take a slice, the cake doubles in size. How many slices of cake are you going to have? And infinitely many. But it does depend on the rate of expansion being quicker than the rate of decay. But according to Guth, any successful inflationary model, the rate of exponential expansion is always much faster than the rate of exponential decay. So let's go to the critics. What's the case against the inflationary multiverse? Well, we have alternatives to inflation. Inflation just might not be right. We heard from Robert this morning. We heard from Latham yesterday. So there are alternatives to inflation. Anthropics could be solved by an alternative scheme. So there's another scheme called cosmological natural selection. I will go a little bit more detail into that a little later. Some philosophers argue that there is no fine-tuning or anthropic coincidence to be solved, that we've got no right to say that the constants have surprising values because we don't know what generates them. And also Raphael Sorkin predicted dark energy without using anthropics, so Weinberg's prediction is not unique. And speaking to some cosmologists, they think it might be easier to generate inflation without a multiverse, and maybe you can stick with inflation and not get a multiverse. And of course, there's the broader criticism that it's just extravagant. And of course, we've heard that it's not science, as it's not falsifiable. Let me put this down. Okay. So again, if I want to pick the strongest one of those, I think it's the fact that we have alternatives to inflation. I'm just going to very briefly flash up their names, and I'll talk a little bit more about them later. So string gas cosmology, we heard about pre-Big Bang, the apyrotic, blah, 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 lots of different models. But I want to come back to this issue of falsifiability, because that is something that keeps coming up in my conversations. The claim is that this framework is not falsifiable. So I put that to Guth and Nomura, and there were sort of two responses. The first was that they do actually make a falsifiable prediction. Then the claim is that they, if you detected positive curvature at this level, then the quote is, the framework of the eternally inflating multiverse, as currently understood, is excluded with high significance. Now, interestingly, I had a debate actually between Penrose and Guth. I put this to Guth there, and he said, well, as long as each individual model of inflation is falsifiable, then we're fine. There's no meaning to trying to falsify the entire framework. However, speaking to philosophers, I get a sort of slightly different reply. So there was a survey done by Brian Alters, and he asked philosophers of science, do you think there is a single criteria to demarcate between science and non-science? And only 11% said yes. So I think from my reading of the literature, so there was a good review here from Pigliucci, and here the editors have basically argued that you really shouldn't think of science as being demarcated by a single criteria. Rather, you use the Wittgensteinian concept of a family resemblance. So unfortunately, that is harder to pin down, but maybe that's something we have to live with. So the quote from Pigliucci is, contemporary philosophers of science, it seems, have no trouble with inherently fuzzy concepts. Science is best considered as a family of related activities with no fundamental essence to define it. So putting that aside, I want to come back to this issue of eternal inflation. Is it eternal? If it's eternal into the future, is it eternal into the past? So this paper...
Sorry, can I
Yeah.
Can I conclude from that that science is a family affair, as long as you guys are people are related to each other?
Yeah. That's basically it. Yeah. As long as we're in the club,
is
you're
that
fine.
Big mafia.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really what's being said. No, I mean, in all seriousness, it's basically you're looking for a whole bunch of criteria. And the more of that criteria you have, the more you can be considered science. So it's not a digital one-off thing. Right. So coming back to eternal inflation. So if it's correct, is it eternal into the future and the past? So this paper here by Bourdais, Guth, and Vilenkin claims that it's really semi-eternal inflation. It's not eternal into the past. And I think that is the consensus view. There have been some dissenters. I'll just put some papers up here for you to look at later. But it's Ghazal here, because she's recently, just in the last few days, published a paper on this. So maybe, can you help us out on this? Is inflation past eternal or only future eternal?
You're putting me on the spot.
I know.
I think I don't know. I think it's not as clear. The conclusion of that paper is that it cannot be always on average expanding.
Right.
Something else could be happening.
Right.
It could be contracting before that. And I think the paper we have is we show that at least it can go beyond the boundary that people think that it's geodesically incomplete. There are cases that you can geometrically show that you can even have, I guess coming back to Chris's question, even C2 or higher continuous extension beyond the boundary. But physically it's more complicated when you put the physics into it. What does it mean?
Yeah. Because actually, Vilenkin, in a popular book, did say that the theorem proved the universe had a beginning. And I don't think that's correct. And when I challenged him on it, he didn't repeat that claim. He said, no, it only tells us that inflation has a beginning. I'm just going to anticipate the topic for discussion later. Inflation, fact, or fiction? I mean, my view is neither. There are strong arguments for, but it's important, I think, to be aware of the arguments against. And I think it's disappointing, actually, in textbooks and in popular accounts, you generally only hear the positive side. And I think we should say the positive side, but we should also point out the problems, and I think that's how we make progress, and understanding the strengths and weaknesses of different ideas. But let's stick with inflation for the moment. If it is real and if it is not eternal into the past, we can ask what happened before inflation. So there's a number of different ideas. So I think the first one goes back to 1982. Alex Vilenkin came up with this thing called tunneling from nothing. And the way he described it to me was that you imagine that space is discrete, it's quantum mechanical, and you suppose there are atoms of space that fluctuate into existence from a state where there are no space atoms. So that's why it's known as a universe from nothing. A similar idea is the Hartle-Hawking no boundary proposal. So this was a shot from the movie that we made with Hawking, Hartle, and Hertog. And they create this smooth region by switching from a Lorentzian to a Euclidean manifold. So that's three space dimensions, one time dimension. And here you have four space dimensions and no time dimension. There's been a lot of controversy about this for the decades since it's been proposed. I won't have time to go into all of it, so I'll just mention the most recent one. There was a paper by Feldebrugger, Lerners, and Turok. They used this mathematical machinery called Picard-Lipschitz theory. And they claim that when you do that, you don't get our smooth homogeneous universe. So it basically ruins the model. So I put this to Halliwell and Hertog, and they basically claim that they're not using the right definition of the no boundary proposal. So after this paper came out, they put what they called as the manifesto, what they think the no boundary wave function should be. But when I made the film with them, I did get something quite surprising, because Hertog admitted to me that this shuttlecock construction, which is what you often see in the popular accounts of the model, he said, and I'll quote him, the shuttlecock construction is really an approximate construction. It's an approximation of this path integral, which has never been defined mathematically precisely. So maybe that's why you have this controversy, because there is freedom to define it in different ways. But these models are from the early 80s, before we had string theory, before we had loop quantum gravity. And obviously people have tried to find models of the early universe using these different ideas. So I'll start with string theory. Now, people have tried to find inflation in string theory, but I want to move off from that, because we've talked a lot about inflation. So the first one, would I be right in saying yours was the first, string gas cosmology? We heard about that this morning, so I probably shouldn't say too much about that, but if you missed this morning, the idea is that this is the radius of the universe, this is the temperature, and in string theory, the temperature doesn't go up, you get to this quasi-static phase. One question for you, Robert, actually, because Ali Nayeri, when he was in our film, and he did describe that it was also could be thought of as a bouncing universe rather than just a static phase. Is that right? How do you see the difference?
I've never heard of a toy model, yes.
Right, okay, so from a toy model, you could go either way. So you get this static phase, and then before that, you could be contracting or you could carry on in the contraction. And as we heard this morning, there's also a mechanism for why you see, three spatial dimensions, sorry, wrong bit. But the key point here is that you have a thermal origin of structure rather than from quantum fluctuations. And the paper here claimed that they get a scale invariant spectrum and primordial gravitational waves. And there's this mechanism we heard this morning about how to get three spatial dimensions. So the more well-known string-inspired model, there are several, actually. I won't have time to go over them. This got a lot of publicity, the ekpyrotic cyclic model, maybe because it's just this really dramatic picture. The idea was that there's these brains in a Jarva-Witten theory, and when they collide, they heat up the universe, and that's our Big Bang. And that didn't quite work out as they initially proposed it, so they sort of modified it to become a cyclic universe. And then the idea was that some of the forces between the brains would change the behavior of dark energy. So basically you would have this bit, I guess, is the inflationary phase, but that happens in the distant future, and then it switches and you get this slow contraction. But since this was proposed, Turok has certainly moved off proposing for this, and Steinhardt has sought to detach it from its M-theory roots and just focus on this way that dark energy evolves and create a cyclic model and forget about the whole picture of the colliding brains. So, and it's sort of inspired, I think it goes back to Latham Boyle, this sort of duality between a contracting or ekpyrotic contraction, which is a slow contraction, and inflation. So the idea, the way the Steinhardt described it to me, was using this familiar balloon analogy. So to quote him, he said, in slow contraction, so we're trying to solve, why is the universe so flat? In slow contraction, what happens is the balloon is very slowly contracting. The Hubble radius is shrinking very, very fast. So yes, it's becoming more curved, but the amount of curvature that you actually see is shrinking even faster. So what's important is the relationship between how fast the balloon is growing versus how much of the balloon we can see. So the claim is then that you can solve those problems from inflation with this period of contraction. And that's his work with Anna Ias, that's what they're trying to do. So some criticisms of some of these string models. So Alan Guth pointed out that this is very speculative physics, inflation is known physics. When I mentioned to Andre Linde, the claim was that the calculation of perturbations used the wrong frame of reference. So there was a debate, should they be using the Einstein frame or the string frame? And of course, Robert will basically say, I think, was the criticism that they were assuming dilaton gravity, and string theory, string gas cosmology is not dilaton gravity.
There's a negative history for on this issue.
Right. Yeah, so that's important. So when I asked Ali about string gas cosmology, he did say that the universe has to start off flat, whereas inflation makes it flat, but Robert was saying the new model solves that problem. But is that right? Okay, so ekpyrotic universe is just inflation at a different era because I have this long exponential expansion. So there's a nice quote I got from Guth, and he said, when I'm feeling snarky, I say that the ekpyrotic model is just inflation plus a bounce, and everything works about it except the bounce. that is a criticism that there's no clear singularity resolution, although I'm looking forward to Samir's talk about fuzzballs, because hopefully there will be a clear singularity resolution in string theory. Another issue is the measure problem that everyone hates about the multiverse of eternal inflation would also be true in a cyclic universe. I mean, that's also infinitely many Big Bangs. They're just separated in time rather than space. So talking of cyclic cosmology, there are several cyclic models on the market. Penrose is trying to resolve the singularity without quantum gravity, so coming back to our earlier talk. So he claims that if you are at the early universe, you don't have any mass. So you can conformally rescale things and you remove the singularity. And then as you go forward in time, eventually everything decays away and you're massless again. And so you can connect these two universes at different eons, effectively, of an infinite cyclic universe. And his motivation is that he claims it solves the low entropy paradox, because when the black holes evaporate, their information goes with them, and you wipe out the gravitational degrees of freedom, and so you're low entropy again at the crossover. So some criticisms. This assumes everything decays away, but I mean, that's sort of put in as a conjecture, I believe. And of course, he's assuming that you lose unitarity for the black hole evaporation. Not a popular view. So another cyclic cosmology comes from Andy Albrecht. He's also important in the early phase of development of inflation. And he's called it De Sitter equilibrium cosmology. And the idea here is that basically it's an inflationary cosmology. You wait long enough and long enough and long enough. And eventually he claims that you could perhaps tunnel to a new period of inflation. So inflation would just start again in our very far future. So criticism of this is that at least the way he's constructed it, it relies on this what's called the Fahry-Guth-Guven tunneling mechanism. And there's some controversy about whether that's actually legitimate or not. So very briefly, there's a whole bunch of models that have a reversal of the arrow of time with an hourglass universe. So time sort of goes forward in this branch of the universe and this way in this branch of the universe. I don't have time to go into them, so I'm just going to pull up their names very, very quickly. We had a talk from Latham yesterday about CPT symmetric universe. There's the Janus universe, the Carol Chan model, steady state eternal inflation, and also the Hartle-Hawking model that we mentioned earlier. Now, that's surprising. I didn't know this, but when I asked Hartle and Hawking, well, so basically they round off the universe by switching to imaginary time. So I asked them, well, what happens if you extend the universe in real time? And the surprising answer was this picture. You get this bouncing universe with the reversal of the arrow of time. I don't think that's well known. Maybe you want to say that we should just ignore the real-time axis, but I'm not sure. And that definitely was Hawking's point of view. But I don't think Hartle took that perspective when I interviewed him anyway. So this bouncing picture is seen in many different approaches. So loop quantum cosmology is another one where we see this. And here the idea is that as you go to high densities, well, you get to, I think it's about 1% of the Planck density. Is that right, Francesca? Something like that?
It's not completely fixed, but yeah.
Okay.
With
yeah, okay. So you get something like degeneracy pressure, or for a more layman's perspective like myself, one explanation was, well, if you pour water on a sponge, it will absorb the water until the sponge is full up, and then the sponge will switch and become water repellent. So similarly, gravity switches sign and becomes repulsive rather than attractive, and that triggers the bounce. So the early versions of loop quantum cosmology was from Boyarwald, but there were quite a lot of problems with that. So there was what's called the improved dynamics version, and there's some interesting claims, I should say. So one is that you get a high probability for inflation rather than the low probability that we saw was claimed before. Well, I should say it's a high probability for enough e-folds of inflation, assuming an inflaton field present. And also there are anomalies in the CMB that are claimed to be seen. They've done sort of the perturbation work and they claim to see some of the anomalies in the CMB. I'll just show you a plot from that paper. So this SA is what they call the standard ansatz, so sort of standard inflationary cosmology. The blue line is what they get out. This is basically the power spectrum from Planck, and the blue line is what they claim to see in their simulations. And the claim is it's closer to the Planck data. So some criticisms. These models are too simplistic. However, Francesca's worked on something called spin foam models, which are, I think, would I be right to say it's more connected from the mother theory. And from my interviews with her, the bounce is still present, right? But maybe the predictions might be different. So those predictions that we saw before depend on what matter fields you assume are present. So you could change the matter fields and you'll get different predictions. And now Boeewald has become, so remember I said Paul Steinhardt was one of the developers of inflation and he's turned against it. So Boeewald's become a sort of Steinhardt-like figure and he claims that it's not covariant. I don't know what you guys want to say about that. But interestingly, so if you remember the claim that Felderbrugger, Lerners and Turok made about the no boundary proposal, Boeewald published a paper saying actually it was called, well, one of the critical papers was called No Rescue for the No Boundary Proposal. And then Boeewald published a paper called Loops Rescue the No Boundary Proposal. So I think his vision is that you get this Euclidean region at the bounce, whereas I think the mainstream view of loop quantum cosmology is there's no Euclidean region, right? Is that right, Francesca?
It's more subtle than that.
It's more subtle than that? Okay, tell us.
You see equations that looks like an Euclidean one, but it doesn't mean that there is an actual Euclidean geometry to that.
Right, okay. All right, so another theory of quantum gravity being proposed is the Jarva-Lifshitz gravity. So the idea is we break Lorentz invariance at high energies. And what interested me is that the speed of light goes up as you enter into the quantum gravity regime. And I thought that's interesting. Why? Because there's an alternative to inflation called variable speed of light theory. So this was proposed by John Moffat. And the idea is you can solve the horizon problem not by having the universe expand very rapidly, but raising the speed of light, because then every patch of the sky can communicate with every other patch of the sky. And there's been a particular realization of this called the bithermal Big Bang. And remember, in string gas cosmology, they claimed that you can get a thermal spectrum. The origin of fluctuations is thermal, and that's the same claim being made here. Niyesh can answer any questions about that particular model. So some criticisms we heard from Carlo that we didn't see any breaking of Lorentz invariance with the kilonova data. LIGO got the gravitational waves, Fermi got the photons, and they just arrived at exactly the same time. So that's a pressure for here. George Ellis claimed that it's not meaningful even to talk about changes in the speed of light. And when I interviewed Zhao about VSL theory, he said, oh, you know, we can make it as conservative or as radical as you like. So that would imply to me that you could create various models of VSL. So if that was your problem with inflation, then that should be a problem here. And of course, we might say it's more speculative than inflation, although is that a feature, is it a bug? Because if we're trying to connect to quantum gravity, you know, maybe we might say that's a feature. Yeah.
If symmetry is broken, then I don't think you can argue that it's not meaningful for the speed of light.
Right, I agree, yes, yeah. But nevertheless, people have made the same comment. Andre Lindon made the same comment as well.
In the context of...
Well, I asked them, what was your problem with VSL? And they said it's not meaningful to even talk about changes in the speed of light.
The historical context is that when early on, people like Zhao were talking about this, it was just saying, okay, so just take equations and make C time dependent. And it was not very obvious. But I think later on it became much clearer. More concrete languages that we use. But I think early on what we were doing was much more hand-wavy, like just made C time dependent and wasn't clear. But after the year, I think.
Right. So fourth quantum gravity approach was causal set theory. So here we have an atomic space-time structure which evolves kind of like a family tree. Now, when it was first described to me, I did think it sounds very similar to loop quantum gravity. So I asked Raphael Sorkin, you know, what's the difference? And he said, and I'd love to hear if you guys, he said the difference is that in loops you have spatial discreteness and time dimension, whereas in causal sets you have space-time discreteness. Is that, do you think that's a fair summary, guys?
Formulate the difference in
this thing. Okay. All right, so how could you formulate the difference?
Yeah, enlighten us.
Yes.
Basic assumptions of the loop. I mean, here the assumption of the degrees of freedom can be simplified all the way down to the causal relation between a number of points, which is a very bold idea, very interesting idea, but it's not idea realized in any sense in quantum gravity, as far as I can see, where there are more degrees of freedom at the fundamental level of the theory.
Right, okay.
Maybe
Yakan
can also.
Sorry?
How about Yasaman? Do you have?
Do you want to help us out?
Yasaman is a Somewhere, yeah. I get it.
Yes, she works on causal sets, I guess.
Yeah.
Causal set representative in house.
I mean, I can say the causal set picture you described is accurate, but I can't necessarily speak for the loop.
Okay. All right, so the idea, as I understand it, is that you have the evolution of the universe. This bit in grey is where we're approximating the classical space. So at the Big Bang, we still have an evolution up before this, but it's not approximating the classical space time. So time still exists before the Big Bang. One paper that caught my eye was this one by Faye Dauker and Stav Zalel. And the claim is that they can sort of realize Lee Smolin's proposal for cosmological universal collection. So for those that don't know what that is, the idea is that black holes bounce, and they bounce out into a new universe, and they inherit the values for the cosmological, for the constants of nature of the previous eon, if you like, or previous universe, but with a very small variation. So what you have then it's something very, very similar to Darwinian natural selection.
Do you have a microphone?
Oh, is it fallen off? It's fallen off. Sorry.
Okay.
It's fallen off. Let's put that back on. Okay. Is that better? All good? Okay. So basically, you have a sort of Darwinian principle for the cosmos. So you're selecting for black holes, and then life becomes a sort of happy byproduct because black holes are associated with star formation, and that's your alternative solution to anthropic coincidences or why the universe is fine-tuned for life that we mentioned earlier. So there are lots of different black hole genesis models. Some earlier ones from go back to the 70s. There's another one from the idea of torsion, so the sort of twisting of space-time, and Poplosky has been pushing this and saying that also triggers a bounce. And there have been models from brain world scenarios, from string theory, and from loop quantum gravity. So some criticism. So I asked Roger Penrose about this, and he said, well, the main roadblock for trying to sort of create a black hole genesis model is that it's the Ricci curvature that's infinite at the Big Bang, whereas in the black hole, it's the Weyl curvature. So basically, the Big Bang is very smooth, and black holes are really messy. So the torsion bounce, you know, is right where you might think quantum gravity should affect, and it's really not including quantum gravity. The brain world model, and Niyesh and Robert Mann worked on, was not consistent with observations, right? So maybe it could be tweaked, but it doesn't look good at the moment. And the LQ loop quantum gravity bounce, well, I made a film about black holes, and Jerzy Lewandowski said, well, they're attending two scenarios. The other one, which Carlo and Francesca explore, is that the bounce doesn't go into create a new region of space-time, but rather into the very far future. And Carlo's going to be talking about that on Friday, so I won't say any more about that. Of course, we have emergent space-time models. So Robert, so I think this is the banner phrase from Nina Akani-Hamed, space-time is doomed. And so we heard from Robert about this model. And we're also going to hear about holographic cosmology from Paul. But we won't hear from Sean Carroll. So I'm going to say what he has to say. He's created this idea called space from Hilbert space. And the idea, as he explained it to me, is that you don't quantize gravity. Rather, that you try to find gravity within quantum mechanics. So you start from the wave function, and you define distances as the degrees of entanglement between qubits. So there are fewer entangled qubits as we follow the evolution backwards in time. Eventually, you arrive at the point where there's the fewest entangled qubits. And Carroll claims that he can calculate when that happens, and that's at the beginning of inflation. So some criticisms. So I don't know if this is applicable to the holographic model, but you know, ADS-CFT, two different space-times, neither of which are our world. How relevant is it? So the space from Hilbert space, I think, obviously it's a bit too vague at the moment. Now, another class of models, which I think are really cool, are ones that have a closed time-like curve in them, because this gets rid of those sort of pesky, what happened before that, and what happened before that, and what happened before that type of question. So the first version of this was from Gordon Lee. in 97. And he assumes eternal inflation. And then at the origin, the boundary point, you have a closed timelight curve here. A newer version of this is called periodic time cosmology. So here, the whole universe is a sort of closed timelight curve. And how do you match this cold, empty universe with the hot and dense universe? You use the conformal rescaling trick of Penrose. So it's a sort of fusion, if you like, of the CCC model and the Gott and Lee model. So some criticisms of those. Obviously, you've got Hawking's chronology protection conjecture. If that's right, these models are out. And unlike the universe, this doesn't come from nowhere. Hiscock claimed that the vacuum state associated with the Gott and Lee model was unstable. The periodic time cosmology, they did compute perturbations and compare them with the Planck data. And they had to get it to fit, they had to assume dark energy increases slowly over time. So if you think dark energy is a cosmological constant, this is not going to be your favorite model. But this brings me on to the question of comparing it with the data more generally. So because these are speculative ideas, let's be honest, right? They're very speculative. Can we confront any of them with data? So let's just look at what data might... Yeah.
On the previous slide.
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
I was real interested in that Gott-Lee model. But,
yeah, yeah.
Hiscock's criticism seems like it's misplaced because as far as I know, you can't even define a vacuum, let alone ask whether it's unstable or not. Like there's a problem doing quantum field theory in a non-time orientable space-time. That's at the level of quantum field theory before you get to quantum gravity. But it seems like an interesting obstruction to having a non-time orientable space-time. There's been work on that by a few people like Friedman and Dubuque.
Okay.
So Rich Gott and Lee worked on this and showed that with particular, if you satisfy, so basically there are some singularities that are resolved with, if you satisfy some condition. So they claim they can construct consistent vacuums.
No, I mean, at the level of a geometry, there's beautiful solutions, like the antipodal identification of De Sitter space makes a nice example. But the problem is if you try to put quantum fields into that space-time and you have defined quantum field theory, there's an obstruction.
I'm saying if you satisfy some conditions, they claim that they basically compute the expectation of energy momentum tensor and show it's finite.
No, but it's not a problem of infinity. It's a problem of even defining the theory in the first place.
Okay. Well, I mean, as you said, they claim that they can define it. But
who is they?
Gott and Lee.
Gott and Lee, yeah. So they construct all the 2.5 functions of the vacuum of the field.
I think Higuchi and Friedman came after them and showed that it didn't make sense, but I might be wrong about that.
Yeah.
We can talk about that.
Okay. Right, so let's move on to how we might get some data. I think there's obviously so many different things to mention. I won't have time to go over them all. But I think the first place to look is CMB, and people are hoping to see B modes from primordial gravitational waves, and we're excited about the Simons Observatory, and moving on from that will be CMB S4, and going into space, we have Lightbird from JAXA. Now, I spoke to Ichirio Komatsu, who's one of the investigators on Lightbird, and he's told me that it is approved by JAXA, but they have a phase A approval and phase B approval, and it's actually phase B where they actually commit all the money. So it's not a done deal yet. So there are alternative proposals out of India, CMB Bharat, and PICO out of the US. PICO will promise 10 times the resolution of these two, but it probably is going to cost a lot more, so that may or may not happen. Going into the very far future, there's been these proposals, the Big Bang Observer and DeSigo. These will try and go after primordial gravitational waves through interferometers in space, but they are very ambitious. So what are we looking at here? This is 12 spacecraft. So basically LISA times four. I spoke to, who was it? Neil Cornish, who was one of the designers of the Big Bang Observer. And he said it would be stupidly expensive. Each one of these has to have mirrors the size of Hubble and lasers as powerful as LIGO. But the Japanese are actually planning to send up a Pathfinder mission for DeSigo 10 years from now. But that does raise the question, you know, okay, this is going to be, if we want to, maybe it won't be this, but something like this, you know, well, the LHC2, you know, is going to cost $20 billion, right? So maybe as a community, you have to decide what do we want to do if we had that kind of money for blue sky science. So a more imminent technology is SpheroX. That is planned to launch in 2025, and they're going after non-Gaussianities. And of course, we have various missions for dark energy. So are there any predictions that we could look at? So as we heard this morning, the claim, you know, when BICEP made their claim that they had detected primordial B modes, it was a smoking gun for inflation. But what wasn't mentioned is that we really need to look at the color of the tilt. So red tilt, more power at longer wavelengths. So generically, inflation tends to predict a red tilt, whereas string gas cosmology predicts a blue tilt. And what was, I think, rather a bit off, shall we say, was that there was a hint of the tilt in the BMO, and the, sorry, BICEP data, and it was actually blue. But yet everyone said this is evidence for inflation. Bit dodgy, in my opinion. You might say, well, could we not find an inflationary model with a blue tilt? And maybe you can, but there's a paper here that claims that this would come with larger non-Gaussianities. So if we can measure the non-Gaussianities and detect the primordial gravitational waves and get the color of the tilt, then maybe we can constrain this. So for ekpyrotic and cyclic models in the CPT module we heard yesterday, they predict no primordial gravitational waves. So again, we can maybe constrain this. Various different, oh, so for loop quantum cosmology, remember they claimed they could see those anomalies. So we'll see if they maintain or not, and whether we can get better predictions out of the model. Remember that specific model of VSL I mentioned. So that they claim they can predict NS to 4 decimal places. So we shall see. If that gets confirmed, we should be taking this a lot more seriously, I hope. And dark energy, different models predict different things for dark energy. So if we think it's a cosmological constant, Penrose's cyclic model, de Sitter equilibrium are still okay, the ekpyrotic model, not so much. And I'll just finish off, how much time? Okay, so I'm just going to finish off with the twist in the story, because remember that R.V. Loeb was one of the authors of the paper that said inflation can't be tested. And very recently, he's been a co-author of 2 papers that claims we can actually test inflation in a model-independent way. So I won't have time to go over the details, but you can look them up. But it would be really ironic, sort of like Hawking, criticizing Bekenstein and then proving him right. So maybe, you know, this could be a way to test inflation model-independently. But I think there's a lesson here, and the lesson is that just because you can't see a way of testing an idea doesn't mean we won't see one later on. So, and I think that's very, very important, because when people say, this theory is not testable, well, okay, that's a statement of where we are now. But that tells me you need to keep working on these ideas, find a way to test them, because that's how we will make progress. And I remain optimistic that we can find a window through early universe cosmology into a quantum gravity regime and figure out what happened 13.8 billion years ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions,
but let's open the floor for more questions.
Or do people feel like it's time for coffee?
Yeah.
Go ahead. What's your favorite of proposals?
Oh, I definitely don't want to say I have a favorite, because, well, I interview everyone and I need to keep on their good sides, right? If I come down, you know, pro-inflation or anti-inflation, then I can't talk to the other side anymore. So I have to stay neutral. But also, you know, nature should tell us what our favorite model is. Yeah.
The question regarding your experience, trying to convey these difficult concepts to the public.
Yeah.
So is there anything maybe that you want to tell that was striking for you in the response you had from the videos?
Yeah, I mean, well, what's surprising is, you know, I was told don't make them more than 10 minutes because no one will watch it. So the first one we made was about 50 minutes and it had like 400,000 views. So don't believe what you're told. Having said that, you know, it is a struggle to be heard, particularly on YouTube. It's very hard to get your content seen. But I think there's a market for people who have maybe got some basics down but want to learn more. Because when you watch a, you know, BBC Horizon documentary or something like that, they're beautifully made. But they always start with the assumption that the audience knows absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and the problem is there's lots of people that have watched these documentaries, have read Scientific American, read Carlo's beautiful books, and they know something. So they want to learn more. And so I think there's a space for people that you know, have some basics down, and you don't have to talk down to them. And there's lots of great content on YouTube. You know, if you watch PBS Spacetime, you know, some of it's quite hard to follow, even in a 20-minute video, but they get huge audiences. So I think, you know, don't talk down to the public. You don't have to talk to everyone. Yeah, sure, the BBC documentaries, they take the decision that that's what they want to do, and that's fine, nothing wrong with that. But there's a niche for something a bit more detailed. Gazal?
It's more of a comment. I find it because I have kids and there's us. I mean, there are different levels of people who are interested.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Beauty, like, you know, when you pick up a book, it says like, age group. Like,
right.
If YouTube would have something, a catalog of somebody
yes.
Interested in different science, like what is the audience, good audience for that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So
okay.
Again.
Thank you.